time on creating value. If the value is there, we can fix everything else. If it's not, how good our usability, reliability, or performance is doesn't matter. There are several elements of value, and there are techniques for testing all of them. Testing demand. Sometimes it's unclear if there's demand for what we want to build. In other words, if we could come up with an amazing solution to this problem, do customers even care about this problem? Enough to buy a new product and switch to it.
This concept of demand testing applies to entire products down to a specific feature on an existing product.
We can't just assume there's demand, although often the demand is well established because most of the time our products are entering an existing market with demonstrated and measurable demand. The real challenge in that situation is whether we can come up with a demonstrably better solution in terms of value than the alternatives. Testing value qualitatively. The most common type of qualitative value testing is focused on the response or reaction. Do customers love this? Will they pay for it? Will users choose to use this? And most important, if not, why not? Testing value quantitatively. For many products, we need to test efficacy, which refers to how well this solution solves the underlying problem. In some types of products, this is very objective and quantitative. For example, in advertising technology, we can measure the revenue generated and easily compare that to other advertising technology alternatives. In other types of products, such as games, it's much less objective. Chapter 52, Demand Testing Techniques.
One of the biggest possible wastes of time and effort, and the reason for countless failed startups, is when a team designs and builds a product, testing usability, testing reliability, testing performance, and doing everything they think they're supposed to do. Yet when they finally release the product, they find that people won't buy it.
Even worse, it's not like they sign up for a trial in significant numbers, but then for some reason don't decide to buy. We can usually recover from that. It's that they don't even want to sign up for the trial. That's a tremendous and often fatal problem. You might experiment with pricing, positioning, and marketing, but you eventually conclude that this is just not a problem people are concerned enough about. The worst part of this scenario is that, in my experience, it's so easily avoided. The problem I just described can happen at the product level, such as an all-new product from a startup, or at the feature level. The feature example is depressingly common. Every day, new features get deployed that don't get used, and this case is even easier to prevent. Suppose you were contemplating a new feature. Perhaps because a large customer is asking for it, or maybe because you saw that a competitor has the feature, or maybe it's your CEO's pet feature. You talk about the feature with your team, and your engineers point out to you that the implementation cost is substantial. Not impossible, but not easy either. Enough that you don't want to take the time to build this only to find out later it wasn't used. The demand testing technique is called a fake door demand test. The idea is that we put the button or menu item into the user experience exactly where we believe it should be. But when the user clicks that button, rather than taking the user to the new feature, it instead takes the user to a special page that explains that you are studying the possibility of adding this new feature and that you are seeking customers to talk to about this. The page also provides a way for the user to volunteer by providing their email or phone number, for example. What's critical for this to be effective is that the users not have any visible indication that this is a test until after they click that button. The benefit is that we can quickly collect some very helpful data that will allow us to compare the click-through rate on this button with our expectations or with other features. And then we can follow up with customers to get a better understanding of what they would expect. The same basic concept applies to entire products. Rather than a button on a page, we set up the landing page for the new offering's product funnel. This is called a landing page demand test. We describe that new offering exactly as we would if we were really launching the service. The difference is that if the user clicks the call to action, rather than signing up for the trial or whatever the action might be, the user sees a page that explains that you are studying the possibility of adding this new offering, and you'd like to talk with them about that new offering if they're willing. With both forms of demand testing, we can show the test to every user in the case of an early startup, or we can show it to just a very small percentage of users or within a specific geography in the case of a larger company. Hopefully, you can see that this is very easy to do, and you can quickly collect two very useful things. One, some good evidence on demand, and two, a list of users who are very ready and willing to talk with you about this specific new capability. In practice, the demand is usually not the problem. People do sign up for our trial. The problem is that they try out our product and they don't get excited about it. At least not excited enough to switch from what they currently use. And dealing with that is the purpose of the qualitative and quantitative techniques in the chapters that follow. Discovery testing in risk-averse companies. Much has been written about how to do product discovery in startups, by me and many others. There are many challenges for startups, but most important is survival. One of the real advantages to startups from a product point of view is that there's no legacy to drag along, no revenue to preserve, and no reputation to safeguard. This allows us to move very quickly and take significant risks without much downside. However, once your product develops to the point that it can sustain a viable business, congratulations, you now have something to lose. And it's not surprising that some of the dynamics of product discovery need to change. My goal here is to highlight these differences and to describe how the techniques are modified in larger enterprise companies. Others have also been writing about how to apply these techniques in enterprises, but on the whole, I have not been particularly impressed with the advice I've seen. Too often, the suggestion is to carve out a protected team and provide them some air cover so they can go off and innovate. First of all, what does this say about the people not on these special innovation teams? What does this say about the company's existing products? And even when something does get some traction, how well do you think the existing product teams will accept this learning? These are some of the reasons I'm not an advocate of so-called corporate innovation labs. I have long argued that the techniques of product discovery and rapid test and learn absolutely apply to large enterprise companies and not just to startups. The best product companies, including Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Netflix, are great examples where this kind of innovation is institutionalized. In these companies, innovation is not something that just a few people get permission to pursue. It is the responsibility of all product teams. But before I go any further, I want to emphasize the most important point for technology companies. If you stop innovating, you will die. Maybe not immediately, but if all you do is optimize your existing solutions and you stop innovating, it is only a matter of time before you are someone else's lunch. I believe it's a non-negotiable that we simply must continue to move our products forward and deliver increased value for our customers. That said, we need to do this in a responsible way. That really means doing two really big things: protect your revenue and brand, and protect your employees and customers. Protect revenue and brand. The company has built a reputation and has earned revenue, and it is the job of the product teams to do product discovery in ways that protect this reputation and this revenue. We've got more techniques than ever to do this, including many techniques for creating very low-cost and low-risk prototypes, and for proving things work with minimal investment and limited exposure. We love live data prototypes and A/B testing frameworks. Many things do not pose a risk to brand or revenue, but for the things that do, we utilize techniques to mitigate this risk. Most of the time, an A/B test with 1% or less of the customers exposed is fine for this. Sometimes, however, we need to be even more conservative. In such cases, we'll do an invite-only live data test, or we'll utilize our customer discovery program, customers that are under NDA. There are any number of other techniques in the same spirit of test and learn in a responsible way. Protect employees and customers. In addition to protecting revenue and brand, we also need to protect our employees and our customers. If our customer service, professional services, or sales staff are blindsided by constant change, it makes it very hard for them to do their jobs and take good care of customers. Similarly, customers that feel like your product is a moving target, that they have to constantly relearn, won't be happy customers for long. This is why we use gentle deployment techniques, including assessing customer impact. Although this may seem counterintuitive, continuous deployment is a very powerful gentle deployment technique, and when used properly along with customer impact assessment, it is a powerful tool for protecting our customers. Again, most experiments and changes are non-issues, but it is our responsibility to be proactive with customers and employees and sensitive to change. Don't get me wrong, I am not arguing that innovating in enterprise companies is easy. It's not. But it's not because product discovery techniques are the obstacles to innovation. They are absolutely critical to consistently delivering increased value to customers. There are broader issues in larger enterprise companies that typically create obstacles to innovation. If you are at a larger enterprise company, know that you absolutely must move aggressively to continuously improve your product, well beyond small optimizations. But you also must do this product work in ways that protect brand and revenue and protect your employees and your customers. Chapter 53, Qualitative Value Testing Techniques. Quantitative testing tells us what's happening or not, but it can't tell us why and what to do to correct the situation. That's why we do qualitative testing. If users and customers are not responding to a product the way we had hoped, we need to figure out why that's the case. As a reminder, qualitative testing is not about proving anything. That's what quantitative testing is for. Qualitative testing is about rapid learning and big insights. When you do this type of qualitative user testing, you don't get your answer from any one user. But every user you test with is like another piece of the puzzle. Eventually, you see enough of the puzzle that you can understand where you've gone wrong. I know this is a big claim, but I argue that qualitative testing of your product ideas with real users and customers is probably the single most important discovery activity for you and your product team. It is so important and helpful that I push product teams to do at least 2 or 3 qualitative value tests every single week. Here's how to do it. Interview first. We generally begin the user test with a short user interview where we try to make sure our user has the problems we think she has, how she solves these problems today, and what it would take for her to switch. See customer interview technique. Usability test. We have many good techniques for testing value qualitatively, but they all depend on the user first understanding what your product is and how it works. This is why a value test is always preceded by a usability test. During the usability test, we test to see whether the user can figure out how to operate our product. But even more important, after a usability test, the user knows what your product is all about and how it's meant to be used. Only then can we have a useful conversation with the user about value or lack thereof. Preparing a value test, therefore, includes preparing a usability test. I described how to prepare for and run a usability test in the last chapter. So for now, let me again emphasize that it's important to conduct the usability test before the value test and to do one immediately after the other. If you try to do a value test without giving the user or customer the opportunity to learn how to use the product, then the value test becomes more like a focus group where people talk hypothetically about your product and try to imagine how it might work. To be clear, focus groups might be helpful for gaining market insights, but they are not helpful in discovering the product we need to deliver. See product discovery principle number one. This testing involves at least you as product manager and your product designer, but I am constantly amazed at how often the magic happens when one of your engineers is right there watching the qualitative testing with you. So it's worth your pushing to make this happen as much as possible. To test usability and value, the user needs to be able to use one of the prototypes we described earlier. When we're focused on testing value, we usually utilize high-fidelity user prototypes. High fidelity means it feels very realistic, which turns out to be especially important for value testing. You can also use a live data prototype or a hybrid prototype. Specific value tests. The main challenge in testing value when you're sitting face-to-face with actual users and customers is that people are generally nice and not willing to tell you what they really think. So all of our tests for value are designed to make sure the person is not just being nice to you. Using money to demonstrate value. One technique I like for gauging value is to see if the user would be willing to pay for it, even if you have no intention of charging them for it. We are looking for the user to pull out his or her credit card right then and there and ask to buy the product. But we don't really want the card information. If it's an expensive product for businesses, beyond what someone would put on a credit card, you can ask people if they will sign a non-binding letter of intent to buy, which is a good indicator that people are serious. Using reputation to demonstrate value. But there are other ways a user can pay for a product. You can see if they would be willing to pay with their reputation. You can ask them how likely they'd be to recommend the product to their friends or coworkers or boss, typically on a scale of 0 to 10.
You can ask them to enter the email of their boss or their friends for a recommendation. Even though we don't save the emails, it's very meaningful if people are willing to provide them.
Using time to demonstrate value. Especially with businesses, you can also ask the person if they'd be willing to schedule some significant time with you to work on this, even if we don't need it. This is another way people pay for value. Using access to demonstrate value. You can also ask people to provide the login credentials for whatever product they would be switching from because you tell them there's a migration utility or something. Again, we don't really want their login and password. We just want to know if they value our product highly enough that they're truly willing to switch right then and there. Iterating the prototype. Remember, this is not about proving anything. It's about rapid learning. As soon as you believe you have a problem or you want to try a different approach, you try it. For example, if you show your prototype to two different people and the response you get is substantially different, your job is to try to figure out why. Maybe you have two different types of customers with different kinds of problems. Maybe you have different kinds of users with different skill sets or domain knowledge. Maybe they are running different solutions today. And one is happy with their current solution, and one is not. You might determine that you just aren't able to get people interested in this problem, or you can't figure out a way to make this usable enough that your target users can realize this value. In that case, you may decide to stop right there and put the idea on the shelf. Some product managers consider this a big failure. I view it as saving the company the wasted cost of building and shipping a product your customers don't value and won't buy. Plus the opportunity cost of what your engineering team could be building instead. The remarkable thing about this kind of qualitative testing is just how easy and effective it is. The best way to prove this to yourself is to take your laptop or mobile device with your product or prototype on it to someone who hasn't seen it yet and just give it a try. One important note. As product manager, you need to make sure you are at every single qualitative value test. Do not delegate this, and certainly don't try to hire a firm to do this for you. Your contribution to the team comes from experiencing as many users as possible firsthand, interacting with and responding to your team's ideas. If you worked for me, the continuation of your monthly salary would depend on this. Chapter 54, Quantitative Value Testing Techniques. While qualitative testing is all about fast learning and big insights, quantitative techniques are all about collecting evidence. We will sometimes collect enough data that we have statistically significant results, especially with consumer services with a lot of daily traffic. And other times we'll set the bar lower and just collect actual usage data that we consider useful evidence, along with other factors, to make an informed decision. This is the main purpose of the live data prototype we discussed earlier. As a reminder, a live data prototype is one of the forms of prototype created in product discovery intended to expose certain use cases to a limited group of users to collect some actual usage data. We have a few key ways to collect this data, and the technique we select depends on the amount of traffic we have, the amount of time we have, and our tolerance for risk. In a true startup environment, we don't have much traffic, and we also don't have much time, but we're usually fine with risk. We don't have much to lose yet. In a more established company, we often have a lot of traffic. We have some amount of time. Mostly we're worried about management losing patience. And the company is usually more averse to risk. A/B testing. The gold standard for this type of testing is an A/B test. The reason we love A/B tests is because the user doesn't know which version of the product she is seeing. This yields data that is very predictive, which is what we ideally want. Keep in mind that this is a slightly different type of A/B test than optimization A/B testing. Optimization testing is where we experiment with different calls to action, different color treatments on a button, and so forth. Conceptually, they are the same, but in practice, there are some differences. Optimization testing is normally surface-level, low-risk changes, which we often test in a split test, 50-50. In discovery A/B testing, we usually have the current product showing to 99% of our users and the live data prototype showing to only 1% of our users or less. We monitor the A/B test more closely. Invite-only testing. If your company is more risk-averse, or if you just don't have enough traffic to be able to show to 1% or even 10% and get useful results anytime soon, then another effective way to collect evidence is the invite-only test. This is where you identify a set of users or customers that you contact and invite to try the new version. You tell them that it is an experimental version, so they are effectively opting in if they choose to run it. The data that this group generates is not as predictive as from a true blind A/B test. We realize that those who opt in are generally more early adopter types. Nevertheless, we are getting a set of actual users doing their work with our live data prototype, and we are collecting really interesting data. I can't tell you how often we think we have something they'll love, and then we make it available to a limited group like this, and we find that they are just not feeling it. Unfortunately, with a quantitative test like this, all we know for sure is that they are not using it. We can't know why. That's when we'll follow up with a qualitative test to try and quickly learn why they're not as into it as we had hoped. Customer discovery program. A variation of the invite-only test is to use the members of the customer discovery program we discussed in the section on ideation techniques. These companies have already opted in to testing new versions, and you already have a close relationship with them so that you can follow up with them easily. For products for businesses, I typically use this as my primary technique for collecting actual usage data. We have the customer discovery program customers getting frequent updates to the live data prototype, and we compare their usage data to that of our broader customers. The role of analytics. One of the most significant changes in how we do product today is our use of analytics. Any capable product manager today is expected to be comfortable with data and understand how to leverage analytics to learn and improve quickly. I attribute this change to several factors. First, as the market for our products has expanded dramatically due to access globally, and also by way of connected devices, the sheer volume of data has dramatically increased, which gives us interesting and statistically significant results much faster. Second, the tools for accessing and learning from this data have improved significantly. Mostly, however, I see an increased awareness of the role that data can play in helping you learn and adapt quickly. There are five main uses of analytics in strong product teams. Let's take a close look at each of these uses. Understand user and customer behavior. When most people think of analytics, they think of user analytics. That is, however, but one type of analytic. The idea is to understand how our users and customers are using our products. Remember, there can be many users at a single customer, at least in the B2B context. We may do this to identify features that are not being used, or to confirm that features are being used as we expect, or simply to gain a better understanding of the difference between what people say and what they actually do. This type of analytic has been collected and used for this purpose by good product teams for at least 30 years, a solid decade before the emergence of the web. Desktops and servers were able to call home and upload behavior analytics, which were then used by the product team to make improvements. This, to me, is one of the very few non-negotiables in product. My view is that if you're going to put a feature in, you need to put in at least the basic usage analytics for that feature. Otherwise, how will you know if it's working as it needs to? Measure product progress. I have long been a strong advocate of using data to drive product teams. Rather than provide the team an old-style roadmap listing someone's best guess of what features may or may not work, I strongly prefer to provide the product team with a set of business objectives with measurable goals, and then the team makes the calls as to what are the best ways to achieve those goals. It's part of the larger trend in product to focus on outcome and not output. Prove whether product ideas work. Today, especially for consumer companies, we can isolate the contribution of new features, new versions of workflows, or new designs by running A/B tests and then comparing the results. This lets us prove which of our ideas work. We don't have to do this with everything, but with things that have high risk or high deployment costs or that require changes in user behavior, this can be a tremendously powerful tool. Even where the volume of traffic is such that collecting statistically significant results is difficult or time-consuming, we can still collect actual data from our live data prototypes to make decisions that are much better informed. Inform product decisions. In my experience, the worst thing about product in the past was its reliance on opinions. And usually, the higher up in the organization the person who voiced it, the more that opinion counted. Today, in the spirit of data beats opinions, we have the option of simply running a test, collecting some data, and then using that data to inform our decisions. The data is not everything, and we are not slaves to it. But I find countless examples today in the best product teams of decisions informed by test results. I hear constantly from teams how often they are surprised by the data and how minds are changed by it. Inspire product work. While I am personally hooked on each of the above roles of analytics, I must admit that my personal favorite is this last point. The data we aggregate from all sources can be a goldmine. It often boils down to asking the right questions, but by exploring the data, we can find some very powerful product opportunities. Some of the best product work I see going on right now was inspired by the data. Yes, we often get great ideas by observing our customers, and we do often get great ideas by applying new technology. But studying the data itself can provide insights that lead to breakthrough product ideas. Largely, this is because the data often catches us off guard. We have a set of assumptions about how the product is used, most of which we are not even conscious of. And when we see the data, we are surprised that it doesn't track with those assumptions. It's these surprises that lead to real progress. It's also important for tech product managers to have a broad understanding of the types of analytics that are important to your product. Many have too narrow of a view. Here is the core set for most tech products: user behavior analytics, click paths, engagement; business analytics, active users, conversion rate, lifetime value, retention; financial analytics, ASP, billings, time to close; performance, load time, uptime; operational costs, storage, hosting; go-to-market costs, acquisition costs, cost of sales, programs; sentiment, NPS, customer satisfaction, surveys. Hopefully you can see the power of analytics for product teams. However, as powerful as the role of data is for us, the most important thing to keep in mind about analytics is that the data will shine a light on what is happening, but it won't explain why. We need our qualitative techniques to explain the quantitative results. Note that we often refer to analytics as key performance indicators, KPIs. Flying blind. Remarkably, I still encounter too many product teams that either aren't instrumenting their product to collect analytics, or they do it at such a minor level that they don't know if and how their product is being used. My own teams, and every team I can think of that I've ever worked with, have been doing this for so long now that it's hard to imagine not having this information. It's hard for me to even remember what it was like to have no real idea how the product was used, or what features were really helping the customer, versus which ones we thought had to be there just to help close a sale. This is easiest to do with cloud-based products and services, and most of us use web analytics tools, but sometimes we use homegrown tools for this too. Good product teams have been doing this for years, and not just with cloud-based sites, but also with installed mobile or desktop applications, on-premise software, hardware, and devices that call home periodically and send the usage data back to the teams. A few companies are very conservative and ask permission before sending the data, but mostly this just happens silently. We should all be anonymizing and aggregating the data so there's nothing personally identifiable in there. Occasionally, however, we see in the news that another company is in trouble for sending raw data in the rush to market. It seems the press thinks we're tracking these data for nefarious purposes, but at least with the companies I know and work with, they're simply trying to make the products better, more valuable, and more usable. This has long been one of our most important tools for doing so. The way the overall process works is that we first ask ourselves what we need to know about how our products are used, then we instrument the product to collect this information. The particular techniques depend on the tool you're using and what you want to collect. Finally, we generate various forms of online reports to view and interpret these data. For everything new we add, we ensure we have the necessary instrumentation in place to know immediately if it is working as we expect and if there are significant unintended consequences. Frankly, without that instrumentation, I wouldn't bother to roll out the feature. How would you know if it was working? For most product managers, the first thing they do in the morning is to check the analytics to see what happened during the preceding night. They're usually running some form of test almost all the time, so they're very interested in what's happened. There are, of course, some extreme environments where everything lives behind very strict firewalls, but even then, the products can generate periodic usage reports to be reviewed and approved before being forwarded, via electronic or printed reports if necessary, back to the teams. I'm very big on radically simplifying products by removing features that don't carry their own weight. But without knowing what is being used and how it's being used, it's a very painful process to do this when you don't know what's really going on. We don't have the data to back up our theories or decisions, so management rightfully balks. My personal view is that you should start from the position that you simply must have this data and then work backward from there to figure out the best way to get it. Chapter 55, Testing Feasibility. When we talk about validating feasibility, the engineers are really trying to answer several related questions. Do we know how to build this? Do we have the skills on the team to build this? Do we have enough time to build this? Do we need any architectural changes to build this? Do we have on hand all the components we need to build this? Do we understand the dependencies involved in building this? Will the performance be acceptable? Will it scale to the levels we need? Do we have the infrastructure necessary to test and run this? Can we afford the cost to provision this? I don't want to scare you. With most product ideas that your engineers review in discovery, they will quickly consider these points and simply say, no problem. That's because most of our work is not all that new, and engineers have usually built similar things many times before. However, there are definitely ideas where this is not the case, and some or many of these questions can be very difficult for the engineers to answer. One very common example right now is that many teams are evaluating machine learning technology, considering build-buy decisions and assessing whether the technology is suitable for the job at hand, and more generally, trying to understand its potential. Here's some very practical and important advice for you to consider. Holding a weekly planning meeting where you throw a bunch of ideas at the engineers and demand they give you some sort of estimate, either in time, story points, or any other unit of effort, is almost certain to go badly. If you put an engineer on the spot, without time to investigate and consider, you are very likely to get a conservative answer, partly designed to make you go away. If, however, the engineers have been following along as the team has tried out these ideas with customers using prototypes and seen what the issues are and how people feel about these ideas, the engineers have probably already been considering the issues for some time. If it's something you think is worthwhile, then you need to give the engineers some time to investigate and consider it. The question isn't, can you do this? Rather, you are asking them to look into it and answer the question, what's the best way to do this and how long would it take?
The engineers will sometimes come back and say they need to create a feasibility prototype to answer one or more of these questions.
If that's the case, first consider whether the idea is potentially worth investing the necessary time in discovery. If so, then encourage the engineers to proceed. One last point on assessing feasibility. I meet many product managers who hate any product idea that the engineers say they need additional time to investigate. To these product managers, this means it is already too risky and time-consuming if that happens. I tell these product managers that I personally love these items for a few reasons. First, many of our best product ideas are based on approaches to solving the problem that are only now possible, which means new technology and time to investigate and learn that technology. Second, I find that when engineers are given even a day or two to investigate, they often come back not only with good answers to the feasibility question, but also with better ways to solve the problem. Third, these sorts of items are often very motivating to the team, as it gives them an opportunity to learn and to shine. Discovery for hardware products. So many technology-powered products today have a hardware element within them, from phones to watches to robotics to cars to medical instruments to thermostats. Smart devices are all around us. So how does adding hardware to the equation affect everything we've discussed thus far? There are some obvious differences, such as different engineering skill sets, the need for industrial design, and of course, manufacturing still takes substantially longer than software, although it continues to improve. For the most part, however, everything we have discussed thus far still applies, although there are some additional challenges as well. Moreover, when hardware is a part of the equation, the discovery techniques we've discussed are even more important, especially the role of prototyping. The reason is because, with hardware, the consequences of a mistake in terms of time and money are much more severe. With software, we can usually issue corrections relatively inexpensively. With hardware, no such luck. Specifically, there are more technical feasibility risks with hardware, and there are additional business viability risks. For example, with hardware, we need a much more sophisticated analysis of parts, manufacturing costs, and forecasting. That said, the necessary prototyping of the hardware device has been helped dramatically with the advent of 3D printing technology. The bottom line is that hardware products require tackling the value, usability, feasibility, and viability risks aggressively and raising your bar on the level of confidence you have before you commit to manufacturing. Chapter 56, Testing Business Viability. There's no question that it's hard enough just trying to come up with a product that your customers love and your engineers can build and deliver. Many products never get to this point. However, the truth is, this is not enough. The solution must also work for your business. And I will warn you now that this is often much more difficult than it sounds. Many product managers confess to me that this is the least favorite part of their job. While I understand that, I also explain to them that this is often what separates the good product managers from the great ones, and that more than anything else, this is what is really meant by being the CEO of the product. Building a business is always hard. You must have a business model that's viable. The cost to produce, market, and sell your product must be sufficiently less than the revenue your product generates. You must operate within the laws of the countries you sell in. You must hold up your end of business agreements and partnerships. Your product must fit within the brand promise of your company's other offerings. You need to help protect your company's revenue, reputation, employees, and customers you've worked so hard to earn. In this chapter, I name the main stakeholders in a tech-powered product company, discuss their typical concerns and constraints, and explain how the product manager would test business viability with each area. While this is a very common list, and most or all of these areas probably apply to your products, it is also very common that any company will have one or more special stakeholders that are unique to the business. Just because it's not listed below does not mean it's not absolutely critical for you to deal with. The last thing you want to have happen is that your team moves forward and takes the time to commercialize the solution and deliver a shippable product, only to find out that you can't ship because you are violating one of these constraints. Make no mistake about it. When that happens, it's on the product manager. It is your job to ensure that you understand each of the relevant constraints and take positive action to work within them. Marketing. We've already discussed product marketing, which we view more as a member of the product team than as a stakeholder. But more generally, marketing cares about enabling sales. They care about the brand and reputation of the company, and they care about market competitiveness and differentiation. Marketing needs the resulting products to be relevant and compelling and work with the go-to-market channels. So anything that you're considering that puts those at risk will be a major concern. If what you are proposing to build could impact the sales channel, the major marketing programs, or is potentially outside of the brand promise, the range of things your customers expect from your company, then you'll want to discuss this with marketing and show them prototypes of what you are proposing before you consider building anything. Work with them to find ways to address their concerns. Sales. If your company has a direct sales organization or an advertising sales organization, then this has a very big impact on the product organization. Successful products typically need to be designed around the strengths and limitations of the sales channel. For example, a direct sales channel is very expensive, and this requires a high-value product and price point. Or you may have built up a sales channel with a certain set of skills, and if your new product requires a very different set of skills and knowledge, your sales force may completely reject the product. If what you are proposing would represent a departure from what the sales channel has proven their ability to sell, sit down with the sales leadership and show them what you are proposing before you build anything, and see if together you can figure out a way to effectively sell this. Customer success. Some tech companies have what's referred to as a high-touch model of helping their customers, and some have a low-touch model. You need to understand what your company's customer success strategy is, and you need to ensure that your products are aligned with that strategy. Again, if you're proposing something that would represent a change, you'll want to sit down with leadership and discuss the options. As a side note, if you have a high-touch service model, these people are exceptionally helpful for product insights and prototype testing. Finance. Finance often represents several different constraints and considerations, not the least of which is whether you can afford to build, sell, and operate your new product. But business analytics and reporting are often in finance, and investor relations and other concerns may bring their own set of constraints. If there are cost issues involved, sitting down with someone in finance and modeling the costs will be critical to demonstrating to leadership that you have worked out a viable approach. Legal. For many tech-powered companies, especially those that are working hard to disrupt markets, legal can play a very significant role. Privacy concerns, compliance concerns, intellectual property, and competitive issues are all common constraints related to legal. You can save yourself a whole lot of time and grief by sitting down early with someone from your legal team and discussing with them what you are proposing and whether they anticipate any issues or areas you should be aware of. Business development. Most businesses have some number of close business relationships with partners of various types, usually with a contract behind each that has a defined set of commitments and constraints. Sometimes these agreements can cripple your company's ability to compete. Sometimes they are a huge win. In either case, you need to understand the impact of these relationships on your products and what you are proposing to do. Security. We would normally think of security not as a stakeholder, but more as an integral part of the engineering organization and hence a part of the product team. However, the issues involving security are so important for so many technology-powered companies that I think it's useful to call the area out. If you are proposing anything at all remotely related to security, you will probably want to bring your tech lead and sit down with the security leadership early to discuss the ideas and how you will address their concerns. CEO, COO, GM. Of course, with every company, there is some CEO or general manager that is responsible for the business unit. They are very likely aware of all these constraints, and normally they are worried about them. And if the product manager is not also aware of the issues or does not have a plan for dealing with them, the exec is not going to trust the product manager or product team. It doesn't take long for a CEO to figure out whether a product manager has done her homework and understands the different aspects of the business. Testing business viability means making sure that the product solution that your team is proposing will work within the constraints of each of these areas. For those stakeholders that are impacted, it's important that they have a chance to review the proposal and ensure their concerns have been addressed. User test versus product demo versus walkthrough. Throughout this book, I have talked about showing the prototype. In truth, there are three very different techniques for showing the prototype, and you have to be careful to use the right technique for the right situation. A user test is when we test our product ideas on real users and customers. It is a qualitative usability and value testing technique, and we let the user drive. The purpose is to test the usability and value of the prototype or product. A product demo is when you sell your product to prospective users and customers, or evangelize your product across the company. This is a sales or persuasive tool. Product marketing usually creates a carefully scripted product demo, but the product manager will occasionally be asked to give the product demo, especially with high-value customers or execs. In this case, the product manager does the driving. The purpose is to show off the value of the prototype or product. A walkthrough is when you show your prototype to a stakeholder and you want to make sure they see and note absolutely everything that might be a concern. The purpose is to give the stakeholder every opportunity to spot a problem. The product manager usually drives, but if the stakeholder would like to play with the prototype, we are happy to let them. You are not trying to sell them anything, you're not trying to test on them, and you're definitely not trying to hide anything from them. I have seen many inexperienced product managers do a walkthrough with a prospective customer when they should have prepared a product demo. Or another really common rookie mistake is to do a product demo during a user test and then ask the user what they think. Be sure to be clear about whether you're doing a user test, product demo, or a walkthrough. And be sure you're skilled in how to do all three. Chapter 57, Profile, Kate Arnold of Netflix. Netflix is one of my all-time favorite products and companies. But back in 1999, a then very young Netflix, based in Los Gatos, with fewer than 20 employees, was on the edge of going bust. They had a couple of experienced co-founders, including the now legendary Reed Hastings. But the problem was that they were stuck at about 300,000 customers. They were essentially providing the same general pay-per-rental experience that Blockbuster provided, just an online version. There were, as always, some early adopters, and some people lived in places that didn't have a video store. But in truth, there wasn't much of a reason to rent DVDs via the U.S. Postal Service when you could just stop by the local Blockbuster store on the way home from work. People would rent once from Netflix and then quickly forget about the service. They didn't seem very willing to change. The team knew that the service wasn't better enough to get people to change. Even worse, DVD sales were starting to lag, and a Hollywood backlash further muddied the situation. Then there were challenges with fulfillment logistics, difficulty maintaining DVD quality, and trying to figure out how to do all this in a way that covered costs and generated some cash. Kate Arnold was the product manager for this small team, and the team knew they needed to do something different. One of many tests they tried was to move to a subscription service. The idea was to get people to sign up for a month and offer them unlimited movies. Would that be perceived as better enough to get them to change their media consumption behavior? The good news was that yes, this approach really did appeal to people. A flat monthly fee on all the videos they could consume sounded pretty great. The bad news is that the team created some real problems for themselves. No surprise that Netflix customers wanted to rent mostly newly released feature films. Yet, these were much more expensive for Netflix to stock, and they would need to stock so many copies of these that they'd very likely run out of money fast. So, the product challenge became how they were going to make sure Netflix customers could watch a set of movies they would love, yet wouldn't bankrupt the company. They knew they needed to somehow get customers to want and ask for a blend of expensive and less expensive titles. Necessity being the mother of invention, this is where Netflix queue, rating system, and recommendation engine all came from. Those were the technology-powered innovations that enabled the new, much more desirable business model. So, the team got to work. In 3 months' time, the team redesigned the site, introducing the queue, the rating system, and the recommendations engine, all in support of Netflix as a subscription service. They also rewrote the billing system to handle the monthly subscription model. A funny little side story is that they launched without this, as they had the 30-day free trial month, which bought them the extra time they needed. With so many moving pieces and interconnected efforts, the daily stand-ups included just about every person in the company. Between working with the co-founders on the strategy, validating concepts with the users, assessing the analytics, driving features and functionality with the team, and working with finance on the new business model, marketing on acquisition, and the warehouse on fulfillment, you can imagine the workload Kate faced on a daily basis. Yet, the team got the new service up and running and used this to power and grow their business for another 7 years, until they disrupted themselves again by moving aggressively to the streaming model. Kate would be the first to credit a pretty amazing team, including some exceptional engineers and the vision and courage of the founders. But I would argue that without Kate driving for the technology-based solutions that could power this business, there's a good chance Netflix as we know it never would have happened. One more interesting little aside about early Netflix. When they were struggling for cash early on, they offered to sell themselves to Blockbuster for $50 million, and Blockbuster turned them down. Today, Blockbuster is in the Deadpool, and Netflix is worth more than $40 billion. Kate is now a product leader in New York City. Transformation techniques. Overview. So far, we've been discussing techniques for discovering successful products. But it's important to acknowledge that getting product teams and companies to apply the new techniques and work differently is often easier said than done. Partly this is because people are people. But mainly it's hard because the changes are so often cultural. As a very explicit example, moving from mercenary style, product roadmap driven, output focused teams to truly empowered, accountable product teams that are measured by business results represents a major cultural shift and a substantial handoff of power and control from management to the individuals on the teams. Believe me, this is not the type of change that happens easily. Fortunately, there are techniques that can help the organization through this. Chapter 58, Discovery Sprint Technique. I find that many teams, especially those new to modern product techniques, are looking for a structured introduction to modern product discovery. In this chapter, I describe the concept of a discovery sprint. A discovery sprint is a one-week time box of product discovery work designed to tackle a substantial problem or risk your product team is facing. A discovery sprint is definitely useful for more than just transformation. It could just as easily be considered a discovery planning technique or a discovery prototyping technique, but I find it's most helpful in bringing all these things together, so I chose to include it here. Some people use the term design sprint rather than discovery sprint, but as the purpose of the work, when done well, goes significantly beyond design, I prefer the more general term. Further, if your company has been struggling with the concept of MVP, this is a very good way to start getting the value from this key technique. I first met the Google Ventures, GV, team many years ago when they were just getting started. They are part of Google's investment arm